the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Hello, and welcome to the weekly Huffines Institute podcast for sports medicine and human performance. We're so glad that you took the time to download us and that you're spending time with us today. Every week we bring to you leaders in sports medicine and general health. And today is no exception. We have with us in the studio today Dr. Pat Goodson, who's a professor here at Texas A&M. And more importantly for today's conversation, she's also the director of the POWER program. POWER stands for Promoting Outstanding Writing for Excellence in Research. Well, welcome to the podcast, Pat. Great to have you here.
It's great to be here.
I've asked you on today because I want to talk about the scientific literature.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, you know, we often talk about on this podcast the scientific literature, you know, which is where we look for facts and for to know what is true and what isn't true, at least in sports science. And what I realize is that term scientific literature is kind of ambiguous for most folks. So when we talk about scientific literature, what do you think about?
Well, I think about my world, because my world is public health instead of sports medicine. But I think about literature that informs practice most of the time, because I'm a health educator, and health education really looks at, okay, so what? So now we learn this through scientific tests and experiments, but so what? What do we do with that to help people become healthier and have a healthier lifestyle and better well-being? So when I think about scientific literature in my world, I think about scientific literature that uncovers new facts, new findings, etc., but also is aimed at how we're going to use it, okay? Right. So here's an example. Just this week, President Bowen sent us all a newsletter he does every week, and the first item in that newsletter this week was about an Aggie professor who has done a study and found that she came up, and her team, of course, came up with a compound that can dissolve HIV. I don't know if you saw that. So that was kind of like, well, this is really cool. But now the question then becomes, how are they going to use it? And how are people going to have access to that? Is that going to be put into a gel? Is it going to be put into a device? Is it going to be injected? We don't know yet.
Right.
We're still discovering that. So for public health, just uncovering new things, that you know, new facts and new ways of doing things, not as scientific, quote unquote, for us, as getting to that next step of saying, okay, now that we know this, here's how we're going to use it for the public. Here's how people can use it for making their health and their lives better, basically. Yeah. So that's what I think about. But I do know that that's a limited vision of scientific literature, because there's a whole world of scientific literature out there. Take physics, for example. Pure physics, pure theoretical literature, findings that neither you or I could ever understand, even if we tried, type of thing. So that there's a broad range of scientific literatures. I usually use the term in plural, actually, because of that.
Well, but it is safe to say that's usually the place where scientific findings are reported.
Yes.
And how they were done and so forth.
Absolutely.
And so we're not really talking about newspapers and like lay magazines.
No.
These are usually professional journals that are run by societies and so forth.
Yeah, and very technical, usually, in terms of terminology. So only a select number of people can actually read those and really understand them. So there's sort of an aura around scientific literature making it sort of elite, that only certain people can read it and understand it, which I tend to have a problem with that, but that's usually what we think about. We think about science as something that's done by a small group of people that can handle the technicalities of it, and we try to consume it, consume that science, consume that knowledge, use the information that they put out there as lay people.
Sure. And that's certainly one of the things we want to do is here at Huffines is we want to try to help interpret the scientific literature for the public.
Yes.
I guess my next question is, how easy is it to publish in the scientific literature? If I just get up one day and I have this great idea, I could just write it up and send it off and it gets published? Is that the way it works?
Or? Yeah, no. The process of publication in science and scientific literature is a complex process in itself. But even before that process, you have to consider the writing and the doing of the research. Okay. So because I teach writing and writing productivity to scientists, many scientists are my target audience in my courses and stuff. The idea is you have to think about writing up scientific experiments and your scientific findings first, because I always tell my students, I say, you can have the most brilliant, the most elegant, the most beautiful research design and have collected and come up with the most intriguing findings and spectacular stuff.
Right.
But until you write it up,
right,
it doesn't exist.
Right.
And
right.
It's not just writing it up. After you write it up, you have to submit it for publication. And submitting for publication, I compare that to joining a conversation. The scientific literature is a conversation among scientists. Imagine you're coming to a party, all of these Nobel Prize winners talking to each other, drinks in hand, hors d'oeuvres in hand, and they're just eating and talking and chatting. Right. That's the more or less what the scientific literature is like. Right. So if you want to join the conversation, there's some things that you have to do and know about the rules of that conversation before you join.
Right.
So one thing is you need to know, what are they talking about? What are the hot topics? What is the hot topic of conversation, and how are they talking about that hot topic? And I need to understand what they're talking about so I can interject either a good question, ask something, or say something of my own, but in an intelligent way that makes sense in that conversation.
Right.
So we usually refer to that in scientific circles as doing the literature review, the infamous literature review. We need to know what other people are saying before we even attempt to say, okay, I'm going to write up what I found and then put it out there. What you found will be better accepted if it's couched in the conversation. If it's
so you know the background.
If it's part of the conversation
right.
somehow. If it answers somebody's questions, or if your question came out of somebody else's work, and then it's like it's having a chit chat, a conversation among scientists.
Right.
But so there are different processes. There's this process of doing and collecting the data, doing the research, collecting the data, finding stuff. Then there's a process of sitting down and writing it up and writing it up well.
Yeah. Well, let's stop right there, though, before
you
go on.
Okay.
It's been my experience over the years that there are many people, many what we would call scientists, who collect data who never publish.
Yes.
I think probably most academics may have a manuscript somewhere in a drawer or data in a drawer that they haven't published.
Right.
Is that a big problem in academia? Are there people that just collect data that don't publish it?
I would say there are many levels of problems with that, and a couple that come to mind immediately. One of them is immediate consequences for the scientist. I mean, that scientist that's not publishing his or her findings, missing a great opportunity to join the conversation to make the conversation more interesting and to make a contribution.
Because if they don't, they're really not part of the conversation.
Right. They're not at the party.
Right.
They haven't shown up. If they don't do that.
Right. I used to have an advisor who said it doesn't matter what data they collect if they haven't published it.
Right.
They really have no say-so.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think that that's one level of problem. It's a problem for the individual scientist. Because, again, that person may have had the most beautiful design, good funding, fantastic findings, but if it's not reported, it does not exist beyond the walls of that laboratory. Just nobody knows about it. I think the other level of problem is sort of an ethical problem. Whereas, for instance, I do a lot of research with people. And whenever I am tempted either not to publish or not to write it up, or I get discouraged because my manuscript got rejected somewhere, I always think about the ethical duty that I have towards those people that provided those data to me. And I usually do a lot of research that involves interviewing people. And each interview is about an hour and a half, 2 hours long sometimes. It's like, wow, if I don't write this up and present it like I promised to those people, you know, I'm breaching trust here. I'm not
You're doing them a disservice.
I'm not delivering what I promised.
Right.
So I think at least those two levels of problems come to mind. There might be others. For instance, accountability to the profession might be another problem, kind of ethical problem in a way. And also, if you're not publishing and you have students in your laboratory, you're missing an opportunity to model good writing behavior to your students? And where are they going to learn about how to keep a healthy writing habit going while you're doing your research? If they're not watching you, if you're not doing it.
Right. In some quarters, I've heard the accusation that sometimes scientists will not publish data because they don't want those findings out there. For example, Big Pharma is often accused of withholding data that may or may not support the drug that they're trying to market. I mean, normal academia and university, do you see that often? Have you ever noticed people purposely not publishing data because they don't want the results out there?
I think that can be the case. And I'm trying to think from my own experience. I do a lot of program evaluation or evaluations of program, social and educational programs to see if they work. Whatever work means, right? That can be ambiguous in itself. But sometimes there are political pressures from funding organizations not to publish evaluation findings of a program if the evaluation findings are not very positive, for instance.
Okay.
And that, I'm not saying that is always the case and that it always happens in terms of it always makes people not publish. No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there are pressures that scientists face. And sometimes they have to seriously consider, A, whether they're going to publish, B, where they're going to publish, and C, how are they going to present those findings? Because in program evaluation, we have an ethical obligation to be fair to all of the stakeholders in the program. Everybody who has a stake in a program. As an evaluator, we're ethically accountable too. So how can we be fair to everybody, including the funders, who are major stakeholders, in something we're going to write? So I would say some people at some points might get convinced and become convinced that they should not publish a certain piece or that they're going to publish only one piece of it. But there are always ethical implications with that.
Well, you brought up a good topic here, and that is who funds the research. In this case, what kind of where we're going is we need to be careful. We need to look at who funded the research because that may bias what's reported. For example, in the sports world, maybe there's some supplement company that makes something and they've paid to have some research done. And are they going to publish findings that show their supplement doesn't work? The answer to that question is probably no.
Well, but academics should be independent, That's the as much as possible. So, and the only thing you can do in situations like that, I think, is transparency, disclosure, and say this study was funded by the drug company that produced this drug we studied, by the way. And sometimes that's all you can do. But sometimes there's pressure not to publish. So my recommendation has always been for my students, for instance, when they ask those questions, I always say the key to success in managing these gray situations is to negotiate authorship, publication policies, who's going to publish what, when, where, and who owns the data, all of that up front, even before you collect one piece of data, before you step into that lab and do your first experiment. Those things are decided beforehand. If you leave those things to be decided later, it can get really messy because you already have a relationship with the funding agency, your research has already been funded, then it gets messy. So I don't recommend that.
So if you're looking at the scientific literature, you need to be cognizant of the fact that who funded it, that may bias the or what's reported. Are there institutes that fund research that are probably non-biased, like National Institutes of Health or
Well, we would like to We would like, that's a trick question. We would like to believe that organizations that are not for profit in general, so even some foundations that are not for profit, because they're not for profit, they are not inclined to pressure researchers in one way or another. That's what we would like to believe. But there's always, there are always pressures somewhere because of philosophical views, political views, ethical views, etc. So I've always done very controversial type research, and my safeguard is always to be sure I know who's funding and what their policies and their views and their perspectives are before I even start talking to them about funding if I want to go that route.
So the areas where the science really intersects with political interest mm-hmm. or views, those are the areas that we should be particularly cautious about when we start to read that scientific literature.
Absolutely.
Because it might be skewed. We'll call it skewed one
yes.
way or the other.
Yes.
We talked to a guy named Ross Tucker a few weeks ago
mm-hmm.
who's been involved in a very similar kind of thing with the Oscar Pistorius case. And so it's very interesting when science and politics interact how the noble ideals of science kind of go by the wayside
right.
sometime.
But you know, when we talk that way about science and politics interacting, there's an assumption there that we make.
Mm-hmm.
And the assumption is that science by itself is not political.
Mm.
Only when we interact with politics, like government politics
sure.
and election politics, it becomes political. But we got to remember that the broader definition of politics makes every single human relationship between two people or between a lot of people or between groups of people and among a lot of groups political.
And there's politics and science in
there. There's a ton of politics and science.
Right.
So assuming that science only gets problematic when it intersects with election and government-type politics is not, I would say, not a safe assumption to
right.
make, because there's so much politics in science by itself.
Yeah.
I'm not a political scientist here, you know. I just
well, we could get into the philosophy of science here.
I talk about writing.
Today, yeah. Well, let's I guess get back to the, you know. So we have a manuscript, and we've collected some data,
sure.
we've written it up, we
mm-hmm.
have looked at the journal that we want to
mm-hmm.
apply to send it to.
Mm-hmm.
Do we just send it in and they say, "Oh, this is great"?
Yeah,
do
wish.
They accept everything, or you know, kind of yeah. walk our audience a little bit through that process, kind of?
It's an interesting process, and the whole process is designed as a whole to sort of protect the integrity of scientific
mm-hmm.
knowledge
mm-hmm.
and the development and production and who joins the conversation. There's some control, and there's a lot of gatekeeping in that.
Mm-hmm.
So when you submit an article for publication, let's say you chose a very prestigious and important journal. And when we say prestigious and important journals, we're talking about usually how many people read it, how many times that journal is referred to or cited by other authors, and how well or how frequently it's actually used in practice. So when you choose one of those journals, you can expect that they will only accept a very tiny number of manuscripts mm. that go to them,
mm-hmm.
and they only take the very best.
Right.
So when you submit an article for a top journal, you got to know that you're competing against a lot of really, really good research, top research.
I mean, good scientific journals' rejection rate is they reject
80 to 90%
of their,
yes,
of
yeah.
their articles.
One,
that are submitted
one of
to
the
them.
Journals that my professional organization is affiliated with has a rejection rate of 92%, something like that.
Wow.
It's yeah, high. So just expect that. If
yeah.
you're prepared for that, then you arm yourself with a few things. One of them is knowing that good writing, good quality writing will count a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you
right.
may have the most beautiful research design, the most fantastic findings, but if you write it lousy, there's no way that journal is going to give it a second look at
right.
all.
Right.
So I've seen a lot of, I wouldn't say mediocre, but simple studies, very simple, that may not even make a huge contribution to the conversation,
right?
But they get accepted because they were so beautifully written sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So top journals consider competition, that you're going to be competing against a lot of people. The writing has to be good. The science has to be excellent, but the writing has also to be excellent. Once you submit it, there's usually a senior editor that's the top person of that journal. That gets that manuscript and usually assigns it to an associate editor under that person, let's say that associate editor is usually a person who specializes in one area of that
mm-hmm.
science.
Right, right.
And that associate editor will then send, if they think that article has merit and it might be a possibility for that journal, it kind of looks like right now that
right.
it might fit, then they'll send it out for peer review. And the peer review part is what really ensures the credibility and the accountability of the scientific conversation,
right,
basically. Right. The article goes out to two or three people in the field who are experts on that topic, who will read, comment, and offer suggestions for improvement if needed on that manuscript. Now, usually, so far, for many years, the process has been, if I'm an author and I send my article to your journal, you send it out to reviewers, the reviewers don't know who I am, who the author of that article was, and I, the author, don't know who the reviewers were.
Right, right.
But that's changing.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, which is an interesting thing. But anyway, there was an assumption there that if we do all of this anonymously, that we're not biased against a certain person.
Right.
So if I don't like your research, Dr. Lightfoot, and then I...
And many don't. you can be part of the crowd there.
And I'm reviewing one of your papers that has Dr. Lightfoot's name on it. I am not going to review it very favorably just because it has your name on it.
Right.
I haven't read a word yet.
Right.
So the anonymity was there to kind of ensure that there wasn't so much personal bias against authors. So once the article's reviewed by people, it comes back to the associate editor. The associate editor makes a recommendation to the top editor, and the top editor usually communicates with the author and says, look, our reviewers think your paper is okay, but it could be better if you did this, this, and this.
Yeah.
Or the editor will come about and say, I'm sorry to say, but based on the comments, yeah, it's really not that good.
Right.
So might want to try again. And some journal editors are kind enough to sometimes even suggest another journal. You know, some of them are really great. And that whole process, I don't know about in your world, Tim, but in my world, it takes at least 6 to 8 months.
Right.
Unfortunately, even now that we're going all online in the review process, submission process, forever.
Well, and that's what I think people don't understand is that the whole process, number one, is very convoluted.
Yes.
Number two, that there is full of rejection.
Oh, yes.
There, yeah, we have papers that are accepted on the first go-round, but more often than not, it's the second journal or the third journal that we apply to. Yeah. And also that it takes time to do this. So the stuff that you read in the scientific literature is a year old, two years old by the time it actually hits the literature.
Yeah, and now with new technologies like availability of open access and online journals, they're trying to find ways to circumvent that and make findings available almost immediately if possible. Many journals, the traditional journals, are printing online versions of the article before it even comes out in paper print, for instance, so people can have access to the information. But even so, the fastest journal I have ever worked with took, and this was pretty good, between submitting the article, having it reviewed by the reviewers, making the changes the reviewers want, and resubmitting and getting it published, about 3 months.
Okay.
That was like record for me in my world. In social sciences, public health, that's what I mean by my world, we take a lot longer, unfortunately.
I'll ask you a question my brother asked me.
Sure.
He says, do you get paid when you publish?
Oh, yeah. My father asks me that every time I submit something. How much are they going to pay you this time?
Right.
I'm going, the same they paid me last time.
Which is?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Yeah. Actually, some journals you actually have to pay.
To get published.
To get published, yeah. You have. There used to be journals, I haven't seen one anymore, but I have one in my career, where we had to actually, once they accepted, the process of the review was exactly the same. There was no difference. But then we had to pay for publication by a number of pages or something like that. And I'm going, are you kidding? You should be paying me.
Yeah.
No, it's totally, that's also part of that system of credibility and trustworthiness of science. Is that the assumption that we're not in this for money.
Right.
We're in this for developing knowledge and improving human lives, basically.
Yeah, and many of the journals in the sports medicine side of things do have, and they call them page charges. You have to pay per page. And nowadays with the online access journals, it's even more. I mean, we've had articles that have cost us $2,000 to get published. So it's, again, that's the misnomer that many people think that, oh, you have more publications, you get paid more. No, it doesn't work that way.
Would be nice.
It actually costs. Actually, interestingly enough, I think the federal government considers that paid advertisement. So some of the, since you pay for page charges, so in some of the journals, it actually indicates that these are considered paid advertisement kind of thing.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting kind of stuff.
Well, and it's problematic because some people who don't understand the scientific literature publication process might view this fact that for some journals we have to pay per page,
right.
Might view it as self-publishing.
Right.
And there's a whole negative image related to self-publishing, right. That you publish because nobody else wanted to publish your stuff, so you publish it yourself. No, it's nothing like that. It's just this weird, quirky policy that some journals have. They have nothing to do with self-publishing.
Well, you know, and part of it, you and I both have had many years of experience with this system, so it seems natural to us. But I know from looking on the outside, the people that I talk to, they go, that seems to be very strange. But the thing I continue to come back and tell them is a good thing about the system is that you know when something goes in print in this in a good scientific journal that it's been reviewed very thoroughly, as best as they can, the editors of that journal are basically standing up for that those results. And so you can trust the results in many cases.
And I believe there's a lot of value in that still.
Right.
But I have concerns now with these changes in anonymity of reviewing. And some of the best journals around in science are changing to a non-anonymous review. So you, the author, you know who's reviewing your paper, and you, the reviewer, you know who the author is. I find that a little bit problematic, so I don't know.
It'll be interesting to see if rejection rates change.
Yeah, I hope somebody's studying that, because I really would like to see the data.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would make a nice paper itself.
If someone were interested in looking at the scientific literature, per se, they don't have to go to the library anymore.
Right.
Are there online, where are some sources people can look at some of that?
Well, I'm not the best person to ask that question because I only do my searches through the library at A&M, which is absolutely fantastic in terms of resources. But I know you can Google a topic and find scientific articles just in Google searches, plain Google searches.
Right.
But also, I think PubMed.
Okay.
PubMed is
And then anything, I think PubMed.com.org.net, I think will get you to the same place.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Like I said, I haven't tried it outside of the A&M library system.
I think that's isn't that the National Library of Medicine, I believe, is PubMed.
Right.
I think they index something like almost 9,000 journals, life science journals.
Yeah.
So
they have a lot, but they don't have everything.
That's right. Yeah.
So we always have to remember that.
Yeah. So there's access out there. People can get to it.
Yes.
And they can see what's going on. And I would encourage, always encourage our listeners, and we try to put citations in the show notes.
Right.
Go and look for yourself.
There's a frustrating part related to that, which is the way some of those scientific articles are written, it's frustrating because you can't understand it. And so I'm always encouraging scientific writers to write good science, but write it in a way that almost anybody can understand. And if they need to understand some basic concepts or ideas to be able to understand what you're saying, help them. You know, make those active links or give them citations, where to go to learn more about this, but make it a little bit more accessible to everybody.
Yeah, more transparency, the better.
Yes, including the language.
Yeah.
Because, you know, every time I get an article that's written in a way that I can't understand anything, I mean, not even, like, I can understand the word and that's about it in the entire sentence, I suspect the scientist doesn't really know what he's talking about. I always think people hide behind convoluted writing. Because if you really understand your stuff, you can explain quantum physics to a fourth grader.
Sure,
That's because you understand it, you can do it, you can do it in writing.
Right.
And you should be doing it in writing.
Right.
But there's this idea that the more academic we sound, the more scientific we are. And the writing and the science have nothing to do with each other necessarily, and I think the opposite.
Right.
The more clearly we write, the better our science, actually.
So. I agree. Yeah. With that... I see that we're almost out of time.
Well,
so do you have a take-home message for the audience?
Well, yeah, my take-home message has to do actually with writing.
Okay.
When you write, aim for clarity, 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 and write every day. I have a little saying that I use with my students, a page a day keeps the stress away. Mm. So if you're stressing about writing, try to write just one page a day, and it doesn't matter what it looks like. Nobody has to see that page.
There you go.
But with time, it gets really good.
Well, that's good advice for anybody.
Yeah.
If you write on a daily basis, that keeps your thoughts clear anyway.
Absolutely.
Helps keep your thoughts clear.
Yes.
So we have come to the end of the podcast, and as always, we have our T-shirt question, and we have Ms. Kelsey Sachs, our producer, here with the question.
What is the average percentage of articles that are rejected by prestigious scientific journals?
Excellent question. Be the first one to submit your response via email to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of our nifty free Huffines Podcast T-shirts. We are getting close to rolling out the new ones, new design, so keep listening and keep answering. In the meantime, we'd like to thank you so much for joining us again this week. Thank you, Dr. Goodson, for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, and thank you all for downloading us this week. Until next week, when we have another leader in sports medicine, we ask you to stay active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Kelsey Sachs and Cheryl Myrick and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.